This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. So this might seem counterintuitive, but right now, in the middle of fall, is the time of year when the homeless are beginning to be at really increased risk. The first frost can actually be more fatal than the sub-zero temperatures of late January. Joining me to talk about the homeless and the health risks that they face is Dr. Jim O'Connell. He is the founder of Healthcare for the Homeless, and he's just been awarded the 2012 Albert Schweitzer Prize for Humanitarianism. Dr. Jim O'Connell, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So first, let's talk about that issue of the cold and how what people think might be opposite of what actually happened. So first, I want to play a short clip of a homeless man named Bruce, who we talked to at WGBH last year. And here he is. He lives in Cambridge, and he's talking about the cold on the streets.
One winter, without wind chill, it was 5. With chill, God knows what it would have been. So I had to just wrap both my 2 sleeping bags around me at night and my thick winter coat, and I'd still be shivering.
Jim O'Connell, what happens around this time of year to the homeless?
This is a particularly dangerous time of the year. And I should emphasize that all when you're living outside, any time of year can be very dangerous. But what happens at this time of year is we have these really almost delightfully warm days. And as we get nearer to winter, the warm days evolve into very cold nights. So you get a radical change in temperature from 60 in the day to going down to like 30 and 32 at night. And much to our surprise, initially, and this goes back many years now, we used to think that people would be most at risk for frostbite and death during the very, very cold nights of the year, and they certainly are. But when people get caught unaware, it's when you fall asleep outside when it's 60 degrees at 7 o'clock at night, but by midnight it's 32 and you're not protected. And the worst cases of frostbite we've seen, the worst cases of hypothermia over these last 20 years have really occurred during what we call the sort of the cushions or the shoulder months before and after wintertime.
So let me back up and ask you, I think so many of us, we go about our lives, we know that homeless people exist, but our connection to them sort of mentally, socially, is very distant. How did you become interested as a doctor in treating the homeless and in just interacting with them on a large scale the way you've done for many years?
Well, I assure you it was entirely by serendipity. And I actually have to blame or maybe praise my chief of medicine at Mass General, where I was training in internal medicine, who's Dr. John Potts, and Dr. Tom Durant, who is another mentor of mine at Mass General, who are both very much involved in the creation of a healthcare for the homeless program around the city of Boston. They were working with the mayor, and the community was looking for a full-time doctor. They couldn't find one, so I just basically got dragged into the principal's office and made this offer that I couldn't refuse.
So now you've been working for decades on looking at the homeless. And as you've done it, have you noticed your own attitudes towards the homeless changing?
I think every one of the folks that I've been working with for all these years has had that experience. I think is almost a paradox that I think there are the street folks in particular, certainly, and also the people living in shelters, are people we see all the time, but there's a sort of innate distance as we walk by. And when you become their doctor, that distance, bridging that distance becomes critical if you expect to care for them. And as we get to know people, regardless of whatever exterior things they throw at us to try to keep us away, you start to realize that many, many of them, if not most of them, have been dealt terrible hands in life. They're dealing with unbelievable obstacles. And as you become to appreciate their life journeys, you start to see the real courageous and kind of brave part of what they're doing, which had been initially just invisible to us or couched in an abrasive person or someone who was yelling at you as you walked by. I've been stunned by the courage that we see by people who have really managed to live outside and in the shelters for years.
Talk about some of that courage and bravery examples that we might be surprised by, that you've seen.
Well, we've seen all the examples. I could regale you with legions of stories, but several stand out. I mean, we took care of a man who had been on the streets for 52 years.
Wow.
He was a terrific man, but very furtive. And I couldn't really get him to let me take his blood pressure or really get into any kind of medical discussions. But he told me he had been the youngest professor at Columbia University, and he was a philosophy and English major. And I had been a philosophy major when I was an undergrad, so I figured I could talk to him via philosophy. And it turned out, you know, I would ask him all sorts of questions about Columbia back in the late 40s and 50s when he was there. And I was fascinated by the Beat Generation, fascinated by Jack Kerouac. And he would tell me all about these folks. And I would start to say, and we hear this on the street a lot, is this true or not? And one day he did get very sick, and we brought him into Mass General, and he had bad heart failure. And as it turned out, as the residents Googled him, there were the letters of Allen Ginsberg to this gentleman, all talking about how he had helped him try to convince Jack Kerouac and Neil Cassidy not to go on a crazy trip to San Francisco, during which, of course, they rode on the road.
Wow.
So you never know. He was, in fact, at age 16, teaching at Columbia University and had his first schizophrenic break when he was 19. So he had an ascendant career, and his psychosis really didn't break into his life until he had been pretty advanced in his life.
What role would you say... you told a story about mental illness. What role would you say that mental illness plays in landing people on the street? Is that a very large percentage of people?
I think if you look really, really hard at the rough sleepers, those people who really stay outside and avoid going to the shelters, you will find a really high percentage of mental illness. What in fact we see on the streets is that most of the people suffer from a severe and persistent mental illness. They also are struggling with a active substance abuse. But in addition to that, and this is what we have found has been particularly deadly, if I could say that, is they also have several major and chronic medical illnesses they're coping with. So it's this collision of all three, the medical, the mental health, and the substance abuse issues that really put people at great risk when you're living exposed outside.
Let me play another clip from Bruce, the homeless person who we talked to in Cambridge. And he's talking here about paranoia, about mental issues that plague him.
People will walk by and say things that they mean for me to hear, which are supposed to have some kind of brutalizing group therapy kind of effect on me. That's the general way that paranoia does get started, is that a few real things do happen.
Do you hear from people who they have a mental illness and then that is mixed with real experiences that they have that also push them further from society?
I think Bruce's comments are particularly perceptive, and that's what we see a lot. I think if you can imagine yourself, if you do have a few paranoid thoughts that you're struggling with and you're trying desperately to sort out, is it correct or not? And a few experiences outside can just underscore that maybe they're correct. And then you get very confused between reality and what is not. I have one person who sounds a little bit like Bruce, but he will stay outside because when he goes into the shelter, he can't tell whether the voices he's hearing in his head are his or belonging to other people in the dorm of the shelter.
Interesting.
But when he's outside and sleeps alone, he knows the voices are his and he can cope with them.
Let's talk about what you've seen over the last few years. Obviously, in 2007, 2008, the economy started to really have trouble. Have you seen in the last few years more people out homeless on the street? Has the financial turmoil taken a toll?
It certainly has, but I would qualify that. Interestingly, when I look at the single adult homeless population, particularly those living on the streets, I think because of a lot of efforts on the part of the state and the city, a lot of outreach workers, these remarkable shelters who are now doing very low threshold housing programs, we've actually seen the numbers of people on the street and in the shelters begin to go down for the first time in my 28-year history. And that seems to be the economy notwithstanding. Unfortunately, when I look at the family part of our program, we see that the economy seems to particularly hurt families and make them more vulnerable to homelessness. So instead of seeing a diminution in the numbers of families, we're seeing a rise in the families, which we think is probably due to both policy and to the just disastrous economy.
And you've done some really breakthrough research on looking at the effects of homelessness in different kinds of homeless populations. What's the likelihood of different people to perish when they're on the street versus when they can find a shelter or when they're housed? What do you find there?
Right. I sort of have to be humble here and say that I've been blessed to be around people who are really good researchers. I'm primarily a clinician who has dabbled in research. But one of our doctors, whose name is Stephen Wong, who's with us for many years in the 90s, is now a professor at the University of Toronto in Canada. And one of the persons who I consider one of the premier researchers in homelessness in the country did a study on mortality among our population at the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless program back in the 90s. And he published several of a series of those studies. And one of the things we did learn is that there were things that you could see that made people at relative risk for dying. So when he compared the people who died who were homeless, and there were 600 deaths, it was the mortality rate among homeless people across Boston and certainly across the world, whenever it's been studied, is at least four times that of someone of the same age who's housed. So homelessness is a very high risk situation to be in. And what he found is that if you're a clinician watching somebody come into your office, if you had, chronic medical diseases, been in and out of the emergency room a lot, if you had renal failure, liver failure, there are things that we learned made people at particular risk for subsequent mortality. We were doing that as a retrospective study, looking at thousands and thousands of people. So we've learned to just pay particular attention. I can give you an example of one thing that we found in Stephen's studies is that when we reviewed charts of people, if you just have in your chart that you had an episode of frostbite or hypothermia or what we call immersion foot, your likelihood of dying was eightfold compared to another homeless person. So we realized that was a marker for people whose lives were really being lived at some risk for premature mortality.
So, what are the other main causes of death on the streets when you look at homeless people who've perished? What role does cancer play, AIDS, alcoholism? What do you find? I'm sure people make assumptions when they pass by homeless people, but what's the truth?
Yep. I can tell you, we've looked very carefully. This is one study that we are really working on right now. We followed 119 real hardcore, long-term street folks in Boston for the past 12 years, and we've looked carefully at their deaths. About half of them are now dead, even though their ages were only in the 40s. And the leading cause of death, just as you said, turns out to, much to our surprise, be cancer. And the second leading cause of death was liver and heart disease. So we were stunned to find it wasn't they were dying of assaults or dying of hypothermia or the heat. They were actually dying of medical problems that certainly felt an indictment to my own profession that we should be learning how to prevent and take care of these diseases, except that we've learned that the socioeconomic issues that are overwhelming these poor folks trying to live safe lives without a home just overwhelm our ability to prevent that.
Well, I was going to say, let's talk about the pressure that the homeless put on emergency rooms. We talk so much about the healthcare system in this country and in this election about how difficult it is to sort out costs. And I'm wondering, how much do homeless people end up using our healthcare system? And amongst homeless people, who's using it most?
That's a question that we've been obsessed with for a while now. And I had thought, especially when the population of people I care for clinically are the folks who live on the streets of Boston. And I thought, for the most part, they were falling between the cracks. We were just not getting to them. So we've spent a lot of time working with the Pine Street Inn outreach van at nighttime. We have our own team go out during the daytime. We have special clinics for folks. We have a respite program where people can come and stay. And what we found is that contrary to what we believed. For example, that group of 119 people that we followed, when we looked at their use of emergency rooms in the 5 years at the beginning, just before this study, and as we began it, they had a total of 18,000 emergency room visits here in Massachusetts.
Wow.
So we started to realize that here's a group of people using the emergency room at alarming frequency at great cost to all of us, whose mortality rate then approaches 50%. And these are young people. And when we've asked our friends at the School of Public Health at both Harvard and BU, they have about the highest crude mortality rate of any subpopulation we know in America. And they are literally in the shadows of our great medical institutions here in Boston.
So let's say a policymaker says to you, you know, just as an issue of money, I'm trying to reduce those 18,000 emergency room visits by people who are homeless because, boy, we may not think about it very much, but that is costing us a lot of money every time emergency room doctors and nurses have to care for those people. What would you say that we have to do?
I would say absolutely the money should be invested in housing folks. I think it costs us as a society so much money to have people outside unable to get into subsidized housing that we're now realizing we can't take good care of these folks unless they at least have housing. I don't want to pretend that housing is the total solution, but it's the absolutely necessary, if not sufficient, solution. So if we're going to take care of someone who's developing cancer and keeping them out of the emergency room, we have to have a safe place to care for them, and a home is what we need. So I think the movement now that I would subscribe to is that we have to find housing for all of these folks and then learn how to take good care of people with new creative supportive services inside that house.
So counterintuitive, because you would think, somebody sleeping in a sleeping bag on the sidewalk is a lot less expensive than sleeping in a room somewhere, but right. It turns out not the case.
I was thinking about this, for $600 or $800 a month, you can get somebody into a subsidized housing room, but a couple of emergency room visits and you've already cost twice that much. And
right.
That's not even counting the police costs and the corrections costs and the parks and recreations costs. It's quite extraordinary.
Let's talk about the role technology is playing here. And there is this app that has been developed, as you said, by colleagues of yours. And the idea is to look at the vulnerability index of homeless people. How do you figure out what the vulnerability indexes of a homeless person who you find on the street?
I certainly can't take any credit for the vulnerability index, but the very creative and innovative folks at Common Ground in New York, now Community Solutions across the country, have sort of invigorated and galvanized the public will in looking at people living on the streets. And they have now for several years had the 100,000 Homes campaign, where they're getting cities to organize and go out and actually get to know the people living in the streets. And since, of course, housing is still a very rare resource, try to get into housing those people who are the sickest and most vulnerable. And while each city is adapting a different ways of identifying that, Common Ground and Community Solutions has come up with what they call a vulnerability index. And they based it a lot on the studies that Stephen Wong did. But they then created that those studies were retrospective, looking at relative risks, and they created an instrument that you can go out and ask people at 4 a.m. and come up with a score.
And you don't have to be a doctor; just a regular person can ask sort of simple questions.
Right, and I found this. While it's they're working. If you're a researcher, they're looking desperately now to validate that in a true research way. But what it has proven to be is this unbelievably effective community organizing tool where folks who would never get to know somebody in the street get to talk to somebody and start to understand the unbelievable problems they're facing. And this index kind of brings that out. So I've noticed that it's the human contact that has probably been the most important part of that vulnerability index. And it's now resulted in, I think there's close to 15 or 20,000 people have been already housed through this effort around the country. And they're still aiming to get to 100,000 people housed from the streets soon.
And is that the next frontier? Is that where you see addressing the issue of homelessness going, the issue of how do you get people actually into housing?
I think the true frontier now, and as I look at the evolution of our own program, which, you know, began by getting out of the hospitals and trying to get into the shelters and then onto the streets, now I think the future is we've got these folks who are very vulnerable in housing, and how do we as a society and as a profession organize ourselves so that we can bring the services they need to them in their homes, not wait for them to come to us, because I think that's going to result in people migrating back to the streets. So it was a big challenge ahead of us to organize the supportive services to go right along with the housing.
We've been talking about the health care risks that the homeless face, and I've been speaking with Dr. Jim O'Connell, the founder of Healthcare for the Homeless. He's just been awarded the 2012 Albert Schweitzer Prize for Humanitarianism. Dr. Jim O'Connell, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio on 89.7 WGBH.